This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Bourne.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Incubi, Vampires and Fallen Angels, the demon lover in speculative fiction.
Now, before we begin, I really have to ask, Jules, where did you get the idea for this episode?
Oddly, trawling through Goodreads. I love looking at other people's book, you know, their want-to-read lists and their to-be-up piles. So it was things like that. And then I noticed quite a few of these people who I know literally only through Goodreads had books with very similar themes. And I was thinking, I remember reading a psychology paper on this a while back. And it was actually called The Demon Lover Then, and I think it was connected to that book, Women Who Run With the Wolves.
Oh, okay.
Because there is actually there's the whole the demon lover type thing, and it all sounds quite titillating, and you've got this whole branch of speculative erotica that I've not really dipped my toe in, I have to be honest, but that just sort of plays into this particularly female need. But the psychology paper was postulating basically that the demon lover is an expression through folklore and story and contemporary fiction was an expression of but repressed or suppressed sexuality and suppressed sexual freedom more specifically. So it's not necessarily just about sex, despite what Freud says, but there's a strong element of that, and I thought it might be interesting to look at because it's very particularly speculative. Because when you say the demon lover, it sounds a bit rapey, doesn't it? Let's be honest.
It does. Okay. Well, I think we should start with the origin and the origin of the kind of the mythos of the demon lover and the incubi and the succubi and stuff like that, for sort of looking at how it's represented in fiction nowadays. There are a lot of phenomena that occur which have been attributed to the sleep paralysis as one.
Yeah.
But it was also often used to explain surprise pregnancies.
Yes.
Exactly how successful that was. But yeah, just saying, no, I haven't been having sex. I was accosted by a demon in the night.
Yeah.
There's definitely one way of doing it.
And you can go back even further than that. If you look at some of the books that were taken out of the Old Testament, they're now apocryphal, but they were found amongst the Nag Hammadi texts and the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a very particular one that makes very interesting reading, talking about a giantish race that were born of men and angels, or more specifically, born of women and angels.
The Nephilim.
Yeah, and these were the angels who weren't part of Lucifer's army, allegedly, but they came down to Earth and fell in love with the daughters of men and married them and gave up their angelic status in order to procreate like humans do. That's
right.
You know, the Bible puts a slightly different spin on the whole thing. It's really interesting, but again, that's the same sort of thing. This powerful supernatural creature that really doesn't have very much in common with us as a species at all, being lured away by female flesh, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that must go back around 3,000 years. Those stories. So they've been around a really long time. That predates a lot of folklore.
Yeah.
In fact, folklore probably comes from stories that were originally like that. I'm pretty sure there's something in Babylonian myth. And then there's stories about the djinn as well.
Yeah.
Creatures made of fire, but could be lured in by young nubile women. And, you know, anything born of a woman and a djinn tended to be cursed its entire life. So that wasn't great.
You know, taking a fairy lover and producing a child. One very famous example is of Neve and Oisin.
Yep.
Producing two children. Oscar and Flernaban. Interestingly enough, I saw something on Tumblr, which I then investigated a little bit. And it's about succubi and incubi.
Okay.
Now, when I say a succubi, people tend to recognise that as a female sort of sex demon.
Yeah.
And the incubi is the male equivalent. But, and this is true, the succubi or succubus, the Latin original means to lie under.
Yeah.
Whereas incubi comes from the Latin word to lie on.
Yes.
So it's actually about sort of
Positioning.
positioning.
It's not actually
Yes.
about gender at all.
No, and someone made an interesting point on sort of medieval demonology, which was that demons actually don't have gender. So the idea was that the succubi went to collect the semen, and the incubi then put it into a woman instead.
That all sounds horrendously complicated.
Yes, I mean, I think that's what it is, but I mean, the idea is that they are the same gender. There is no one or the other. And that kind of does make me laugh a little bit, because the moment you sort of you take that away, there was a lot of kind of gender politics that went behind this whole succubi incubi kind of,
Yeah.
it was less of a thing, you know? So it might very well have been that the sort of it was gendered in that way so that it seemed less strange, I guess, for some people. But I found that really, really interesting, actually.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've heard of the half human, half incubus, succubus offspring as well, called Cambin, who have
Yeah.
some of the abilities of the incubi, but not all of them.
Yes. So I have a incubi in the form of the Gankhina, Embar Regan in the Hamartia cycle,
Yeah.
and also Rufus's line as well. I've got incubi blood in them.
That explains a lot.
It does.
Like the ever ready bunny.
But there are also a lot of fairies of the opposite side. And again, it wasn't just feeding on sort of lust, it was feeding on love and things like that. So, I mean, a lot of people say that the Lemon-she
Yeah.
had a similar kind of function in that the Lemon-she sort of inspired people. But sort of traditionally, the Lemon-she does have a kind of is associated with those kind of those lust demons. Even though actually the product of the Lemon-she was that she would be the muse, the inspiration to people who would live very sort of exciting, enigmatic, but short lives.
Yes.
So in that sense, actually, the fairy ones were less to do with the production of little wee demon babies, whilst I think when it came to the incubi and the succubi and stuff like that, that was actually more to do with actually producing demon spawn. And I think it was literally because demons can't actually create new life because life is sacred.
Yeah.
So they can't create new life, so that's why they would literally come in, steal sperm, and then use female women to incubate it once it had been tarnished to become a little demon child.
Which is, as I said, quite a weird way. Well, quite an involved way of going about it, really. So I'll just stick this down to my lab. It was also about feeding. I mean, there is a very direct correlation between sex, sexual desire, and feeding. It's different types of hunger as well.
Yeah.
So there's obviously a parallel between incubi and succubi, and sort of the old hag syndrome, the sleep paralysis, so something literally feeding on you while you sleep, but in a
Yeah.
sexual way. You
Yeah,
could
yeah, yeah.
argue that with the fairies as well, because there's all those stories of the queen under the hill abducting a likely young man, and then getting bored of him and spitting him out, and there's not very much left of him as a person after that. It's almost like she takes it's normally musicians, actually. That's always a favourite in
Yeah.
folklore. And once that sort of creative power has been sort of sucked out of him, then that's when he tends to get cast out again. And in the stories, these people are never the same again. They tend not to live very long.
Yeah. Again, it's an interesting idea. It's just I can suck out your musical talent by having sex with you repeatedly. Obviously,
Yeah.
it wasn't just sex. But yeah, it is interesting that yeah, in some cases the Lemon-she gave inspiration, and then sometimes it was taken away. So they did have different sort of functions, and the only thing that really connects them together is that their purpose or that there is a set sort of a sexual or a love element that comes with it.
I mean, if you want to delve even deeper, I suppose, behind the... Excuse the language there, if you want to delve a bit deeper. if you want to get behind the mythology, as it were, then I suppose there's always been a sort of connection between sexuality and creativity.
Yes.
As well. Not wanting to make any jokes about girls going through a stage of really liking boys who play in bands or anything like that. No, seriously. It always seems to have been like a bit of a stereotype that, you know, when you're young, you kind of want someone artistic and creative.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I necessarily ever really bought into that, because I think a lot of the really, really arty type blokes I knew as a teenager and in my early 20s, they were really quite self-involved. But maybe I just had a bad crop, you don't know.
It's the idea of depth, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. But
depth and sensitivity.
but where in the human brain is depth and sensitivity connected with reproduction? Now, is that the idea of nurturing young later, or is it connected with intelligence? So you think, oh, I'm going to have more intelligent young. Because when this is all attractive, mostly for us, is when we're not really thinking about reproducing.
Yeah, true.
We might be thinking of practicing for reproducing, but we're not thinking about the actual having a baby bit.
We can practice.
So, yeah, I think that's quite interesting. But anyway, looking specifically at dark creature state, in some ways, I've always found the idea of, you know, the whole fairy abduction sex thing a little bit more creepy than the incubi, because the incubi just sort of visits and leaves.
Well, I'm done.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'll be back in 9 months with my offspring. But with fairies, it's kind of like, yeah, we might abduct you and then we'll throw you out, and it could be 100 years later, who knows? And then obviously there is the darker Germanic version of that, which we've mentioned before, but the idea of being stolen by the Erlkonig, or the Dark Elfa, but the goblins, basically.
Yeah.
Because goblins are traditionally, the female goblins are traditionally quite infertile, so they're not able to reproduce very easily by themselves. So they tend to abduct females from other species, animal, human, elves, and sort of crossbreed, which is why the goblins are supposedly be such a mixture of characteristics in the lore. And
yeah,
that idea of being abducted by the Erlkonig is really, really quite creepy, because they're a predominantly male race. There was that whole idea of, if you wanted a wish granted and you were a young man, then you just find yourself some likely young maidens and send them down into the earth and your wish will be granted. It's like, so basically you're selling them into, well, you're sex trafficking them to goblins.
That's horrible.
Yeah, it's a really, really creepy legend.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's what things like Labyrinth is based on, as we mentioned before. So just in passing, that's another quite creepy one, in my opinion.
So then we come to, I think, the what makes the demon lover kind of thing attractive now. And also actually in what ways the demon lover has changed. Because if you look at Dracula, that was another one where he was strangely alluring to women, despite the fact that he wasn't actually handsome.
Or alive.
Or alive, yes.
That's kind of a deal breaker for me, I have to say.
Yeah. The pulse was not optional.
I suppose with Dracula, you have to put it in the context of the time it was written. And it was risque stuff when it was written. Not as risque as, say, Frankenstein or some of the others were. But, you know, it was pretty risque. There was a very definite sexual undertone there. I mean, for example, when Jonathan's saying in his diary that he knew it would hurt Mina, but he desired the kisses of the mother and two daughters who'd been transformed into vampires.
Yeah.
When he was imprisoned in the castle. And there was another bit which, you know, it's Mina, and she's kind of in Dracula's thrall. Forget the film. As much as I love the film, it's not... that's not exactly what happens in the book. Victorian times, around the 1870s, and It was strange. In one sense, you in Victorian London, for example, in terms of population, for every eligible man who could actually visit a prostitute, there were probably 10 prostitutes available. That's how high this market for sex was.
Yeah.
Which is horrific when you think about it, because most of those girls didn't go into it willingly at all. Some of them had just come up from the country and got abducted off the street and imprisoned in a room with no clothes, and that was it. And then on the other side, it was incredibly repressive, because you weren't supposed to want women like that if you were a man. That was something you had a bit of a laugh with your mates, and there were awful guides like, what was it, More Girls Around London, More Girls About Town, where someone used to write these pamphlets anonymously and rate the best prostitutes and tell you where to go. So you had street walkers, you had proper brothels, you had the parlours, and you used to get a free sort of sheep's gut condom at the back as well. It was just horrific when you it's both funny and really absurd and disgusting.
Yeah.
But the woman you're supposed to marry might well have been kept quite ignorant of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Not the prostitution, but the idea of sex as something that wasn't just a reproductive act.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was actually an interesting line. I've been rereading the Otori, the Tales of the Otori by Leanne Hearn, I think that's the name.
Yeah.
And in the second or third book, there is a scene between Takeo and Kaede, and she basically comes to him while he's in the bath, and they end up having sex together, as you do. They are married, but afterwards he apologizes to her because he said, I treated you like a prostitute.
Yeah.
And it was the idea that any kind of anything which was lustful, which went beyond just being sex for the sake of reproduction or for sort of a marital duty, anything which was sort of fiery, lustful, romantic, really, in any ways. Not that I'm saying that what was happening to prostitutes was romantic. I'm just saying that this was not something which was for marriage.
So basically anything that looked like fun, anything that was unrestrained or uninhibited.
Yeah. Was no good. Which is why I think actually the incubi and the succubi was actually quite an enticing character because of that repressed view. It was the idea that if you move toward the darkness, you can have that fulfillment.
Yeah, and certainly with women, because, okay, you know, history hasn't really done a lot for men either in some respects, but with women, because a certain amount of control needed to be kept over who fathered what child, women's sexuality has been sort of really quite repressed to the point where we're not actually, or, you know, up until fairly recently, we're not really supposed to have any. We're just sort of supposed to be there. Which, you know, is bollocks, because women enjoy it too.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, as you say, the idea of almost being overtaken by this dark, seductive creature, therefore, is quite an, as you say, an enticing idea. And you're not responsible for those actions. You're then not responsible for being uninhibited or unrestrained or acting in a wanton manner.
Yeah. And also, I mean, moving aside from the idea that if a young woman was visited by an incubi and sort of got pregnant, it wouldn't necessarily be, or even didn't get pregnant, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be that she'd had an illicit affair with someone, or in some cases that perhaps she'd actually been raped by a member of, you know, of the family or something along those lines, and it was covered up. It could have also been something to do with masturbation.
Yeah, there's a strong element of that in there as well. I don't know if you've ever read any of the tracts around the Salem witch trials. There were obviously lots of little investigations around at the same time, not just the ones in Salem. And I've read some that sort of were associated around the same time. And there was one girl in particular who made this claim that, you know, a demon had come to her in the night and had been coming to her as a man comes to his wife kind of thing for a long period of time. And obviously she was, you know, the doctor examined her and found that she wasn't a virgin. But they decided afterwards that she could have easily broken her own hymen with her fingers kind of thing. But if you read this, and I can't quote it off the top of my head, partly because of the language it was written in, it was 17th, 16th century. But to me, what it really sounds like is a sort of 15, 16-year-old girl discovering sexuality and then being really ashamed of it because of this repressive Puritan society she lived in.
Yeah.
And having no one to talk to about it and trying to explain it and sort of creating her own demon, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, to be fair, there was another account about this same girl a little bit later on about how she married her goat, and then when she was told it was unlawful, the goat died of a broken heart. But I'm not sure about that one. Ignore that. But, you know, I think sometimes you have to sort of, you know, read with a whole carton of salt next to you. But certainly some of the wording suggests that it's a lot more about discovering repressed parts of yourself rather than...
Yeah, and then being able to cleanse yourself in some way because of this very puritanical society of being able to say, but I'm not responsible.
Yes.
It was a demon.
Because if you are responsible, then you have to accept the fact that this thing is part of you all the time.
Yeah.
And there are going to be times when you feel like that again.
Yep. So being able to just put it down to men is to an incubi, probably wasn't just good in the case of social standing, but was probably also good in the case of your own mental well-being, because someone who has been raised in this kind of society where things along those lines do feel foreign and strange, in that you've got a sort of a function which is of your body, which says it's okay to do this and says I want to do this, and then you've got this pressure that's constantly around you that said it's not. Again, speaking from experience, you know, when I used to get desires as a child, and then I'd get stomach aches for whatever reason, and I was sure that it was because I was being punished for having desires. That God was punishing me. There we go, missionary school, thanks for that.
It never leaves you, really.
It doesn't ever really leave you. And that was only, you know, that was only from a very, very slight religious background on my part. I didn't really particularly have very religious parents. You know, my dad is absolute atheist, my mother was Catholic, and I really didn't know about it until much, much later on. So yeah, that was from not a very strict religious background. It was just from a little bit of schooling and from sort of the society that I was around. And I take that and I amplify that to a point where you would be going to church every Sunday. You'd be having this rhetoric shoved down your throat. Everything you'd ever learned, everything that you'd ever been told, everything that you'd ever seen gave you a very, very clear message. So to be able to actually come to terms with your own bodily function and desires, and to actually have something else to pin it on, would have actually, in some ways, in a very bad way, actually been a relief.
Yeah, there's obviously another offshoot with this same sort of repressive attitude, and that was, again, it was reflected most severely in the witch trials, and that was that men, if they accused women, particularly if they were men as part of the Inquisition or whatever, quite often found themselves accusing women that either sexually repelled them because they were old and ugly, or sexually attracted them because they were beautiful, and they had these desires for these women. And they knew that these desires were wrong. So obviously she must be a witch.
Obviously.
But I think, and there's something very, very sick and twisted about this particular way of looking at it. And obviously it was specific men. I'm not making a general sweeping statement. But if you want to possess someone sexually and you can't bring yourself to admit that that's how you feel, then the next best thing becomes to control and break and possess them in a violent manner. not by rape, but literally to destroy the thing that's making you feel that way.
Yeah, and you do see that a lot. One example actually, which some people will be familiar with, is Notre Dame.
Yeah,
where you had evil Christian man. What was his name?
Frollo. Sorry, I had to really think of that then.
Frollo. There we go. Frollo, who was obsessed with Esmeralda.
Yes.
It wasn't. She was Esmeralda. I didn't make that up. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was obsessed with her to the point that when he couldn't possess her, when he couldn't have her, he wanted her to burn.
Well, in the book, he wanted her to hang. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He wanted her dead. He wanted her gone, destroyed.
There's a very, very creepy bit. Have you read the book?
I haven't, no.
There's a very creepy bit in the book because Esmeralda has this real thing for Phoebus. Phoebus is a cad in the book. He's an absolute git. But he knows he's to marry somebody else, but he sexually desires Esmeralda because she's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And she's like 15 as well.
Great.
Which, you know, wouldn't be strange for the time, but it's not great. Esmeralda's actually quite a virtuous girl.
Mm.
But she sees Phoebus and, you know, hormones take over. And there's a part where she and Phoebus have ended up in an inn room together. And Phoebus has, like, got half her clothes off and they're kissing. And then Frollo comes in and whacks Phoebus over the back of the head with the hilt of his dagger because he's so jealous. Phoebus passes out on the floor and Frollo considers actually cutting his throat. Esmeralda's so horrified at this sort of monstrous visage that he's got, and also, you know, she's just been about to have sex with somebody, and this ruddy priest has come in and knocked out her paramour. And she sort of faints, but what really stuck with me was the way that, as she collapsed sort of naked on the floor, she feels his hands on her as if they're burning into her skin, and she feels him press his lips against her forehead. And it's that, as much as anything else, that makes her want to retreat into utter unconsciousness.
Right.
And it just depicts this sort of repressed sexual desire really, really well, but also in an incredibly creepy way.
It's
the turning point for all three characters, because Phoebus is thwarted, so the only thing you think of is like, well, I must get her the next time round. Esmeralda's even more determined to have Phoebus, even though he just wants to sleep with her.
Yeah.
And at that point, Frollo's seen Esmeralda half undressed and is determined to get away from Phoebus and into his own bed. And everything goes downhill from there, really.
And that's how it all goes downhill.
Yeah, it was never going to have a happy ending. You can tell from the very first line.
Yeah. Which is perhaps actually then why maybe the trend of having that lover and then allowing it to actually come through has been so popular.
Yeah, quite possibly. Speaking of something that a lot of people find a bit controversial, but an awful lot of women have sexual fantasies about rape. And that's not because they want to be raped. Mostly it's the case of they want to abdicate responsibility and be completely unrestrained in the bedroom or wherever they're doing it.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to. The fantasy is completely different from the reality, but people are only really just talking about this, and a lot of men are very, very put off if women say this to them. And a lot of other women don't tend to talk to each other about it either. But what it comes down to, it is quite literally, you know, I don't want the slut shaming, I don't want the tags that go with that, with being somebody who clearly, obviously, to everybody's gaze appears to be enjoying it that much.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So again, it's a different form of this demon lover idea.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with you, and I think it's a it's a tough one. And I think, you know, whenever you're talking about specific kinks or sort of desires and things like that, we can only really guess or summarize, because actually I people will have different reasons for wanting different things. But I do agree with you that I think there is this element of not having to take responsibility to just being the the receptacle sounds like the wrong word.
It's quite a clinical term, that, isn't it? But yeah.
But you know what I mean?
I do. The receptacle.
The receptacle.
Don't ever branch into writing erotica.
I write great erotica, John.
Do you use the word receptacle?
I will have you know. My erotica is brilliant, and no, I do not use the word receptacle. That'll appear in my next one, you'll see.
It'll be somebody's kink. It'll be somebody's kink. Oh, what did I get sent this week?
Somebody's into test tubes.
No, I got sent lactation porn, which I'd never seen before, but it was really, really not my scene. I was just like, what the hell am I reading?
Each to their own, each to their own. But yeah, going back to rape fantasies, why are we talking about this?
You know it's a bad topic when you're saying going back to rape fantasies actually seems like getting back on an even keel conversation-wise.
Yeah. But yeah, I do think that there is this, and I should add that this isn't just women. Men also have this as well. I think usually probably in a same-sex relationship, but not necessarily, actually. And I do think it's about having the responsibility taken away from you, and literally just the only thing that you have responsibility for is your own expression of sort of how it feels and how you feel and things along those lines. And the idea of being dominated by something more powerful than you, that's a kink for some people.
Yeah. Definitely.
Is being dominated, being tied up, being, you know, all sorts of stuff. So I think that actually and then there's another side to it as well. Moving away from being dominated and how maybe that has played into the sort of the incubi and writing today. There is also the other side, which is the ability to tame something which is untamable.
And that sort of takes us back to fairy tales.
Mm.
Because you have things like Tiger's Bride and, well, the original version of Little Red Riding Hood, which is a lot darker than the sanitized version.
Yeah.
And definitely has a sexual undertone. And things like Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And all those things are, again, largely the originals were, you had women controlling something that would largely be wild and uncontrollable, i.e. the male essence in the form of a beast, using their sexuality, using their burgeoning awareness of themselves.
Yeah, but also then it would be using your purity.
Yes. Yeah, there is definitely an element of that as well.
Yeah, which I think actually is being moved away from now. I think we're moving away from the kind of the purity. Though interestingly enough, I think we see a lot of characters who are virgins. Let's look at Bella Swan, just because I think that was a bit of a trendsetter.
Yeah, and Twilight's quite a good one, because that's almost a classic demon lover type story, but with rather a lot of the sexuality removed from it. I mean, it's there, but it's played down quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But this is the story, you know, that Bella is the innocent in that way. She's literally compared to the lamb.
Yes.
And Edward is the lion. So Bella isn't just breakable on a level, on a physical level, because this is someone who is significantly stronger than her. She's also a virgin.
She's literally prey.
Yeah, she's literally prey. She's never had sex. She doesn't appear to really have had any significant kind of relationship before in her life.
No.
She doesn't seem to have a lot of experience in that. And she also has a certain turmoil when it comes to relationships due to the divorce of her parents.
Yeah.
How she views it. And she wants Edward. That's the thing, is that she starts to bloom as... oh my god, I can't believe I'm using language like that. She begins to bloom into womanhood.
No, 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 no.
her sexual desire sort of starts to rise up. She gets very frustrated because Edward is the one who's pulling back.
Yeah, interestingly enough, she's the first one who brings up a sexual relationship, and she does it after their first actual date when he's kind of admitted what he is and they've been up in the meadow. And
yes.
He stays overnight. She sort of says, well, I was wondering, you know, if vampires, when they get married, is it like a human union? And I was sort of wondering about you and me one day, and of course Edward pretty much freaks out.
As he's prone to doing. But yeah, she is the one who is pursuing that physical relationship. And in some ways, she only marries him so that she can have that physical relationship. Because she's not actually that big into marriage. She wants to be with him, but she doesn't really want to get married. But yeah. She knows that it'll make him happy. But that's the relationship she's after.
Yeah, I mean, I think, a complete adult relationship, ultimately. But yeah. I think there is an element of sort of like, well, marriage itself is kind of like, I don't see the point. I've seen what my dad's been like all this time. He's never really got over my mother. Mum sort of has had quite a lot of boyfriends since then and never really been able to settle down with anyone till recently. I just don't believe that you can have I don't think it's a defining factor of a relationship kind of thing, whereas just like, oh no, I'm absolutely certain about Edward. I'll become one of the eternal damned, you know?
Yeah.
So ultimately marriage is kind of insignificant next to that, really, because that's very permanent.
Yeah, but for Edward, it is that purity for him, because he wants to have that very pure, very, what's the symbolic mark, if that makes sense. He wants the marriage.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth saying that obviously when we say purity, it's the traditional Christian perception of purity, as in,
yeah,
you know, not having had sex before you get married.
Yeah, but also, but he, you know, he comes from a religious background in that, you know, he's obviously from the past, and yeah, he wants to get married. Because he wants to have that good thing, because he believes that he doesn't have a soul anymore and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a, for him at least, there's certainly a religious undertone in that respect. And maybe that's where you can't divorce the fiction from the author too much, possibly.
Mm, yeah.
But yeah, as a demon lover type story, it's quite a weird one, really, because it has all the marks. You have the dark, brooding, slightly troubled, bestial love interest. Mm-hmm. You have a pure young maiden who's going to tame him, and yet you really don't have any... the sexual side of it is very repressed right up until the last book.
Yeah, and again, the sexual side of it is initiated by her, not by him.
You could even argue that side of things, the physical relationship, she gets pretty thoroughly punished for it.
Yeah, which probably isn't a very good
I mean, I don't think that was ever the intention. I think it's a case of, oh no, I need to wrap this up using to get to here, so this is what I'm going to do. But the perhaps the thing that you didn't intend to say was that, you know, okay, but even sex within marriage between a supernatural creature and a non-supernatural creature, something that unrestrained has to be paid for at a future date, and it's not going to be pretty.
Also, then the interesting thing about that is that it puts another problem in the relationship, in that after the first time they've had sex, she's got bruises and stuff, and Edward doesn't want to go anywhere near her, because he can't believe that he's hurt her. But she doesn't actually mind.
Thing is she says herself, she was perfectly happy. She didn't at any point say, oh no, I think I want you to stop now. It's just a case of, oh, I bruise easily. And you're a lot stronger than me. And obviously you're slightly distracted.
Yeah. But I also think that this is probably me reading far too much into it, and I think it's also probably been a little bit influenced by the 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon and stuff like that, which is a whole different kettle of fish. But I think that she actually quite liked the rough treatment, because he has been treating her like glass.
Well, yeah, I think that would be fair to... I think it'd be pretty fair to say that in most relationships where someone wants a full adult relationship and they really know that that's what they want and that they're ready for it and everything, okay, not to be indelicate, but sometimes you want, you know, slow and tender Barry White playing in the background, although not literally, and you know, sometimes you want something that's a little bit more like Klingon sex.
I did not need that in its place.
You know, I won't expand on that, but both ends of the spectrum are perfectly normal, and perhaps that's something that needs to be addressed a little bit more, certainly in young adult fiction. So soft to Stephanie Meyer for doing that, however unintentionally.
Yeah. So what other examples have we got of fiction which has used the incubi or the demon kind of lover?
I've got three, actually.
Go on.
Very specifically, incubi and, well, let's say incubi-like creatures. They're basically non-corporeal, except during the act, as it were. There's right. Incubus by Carol Goodman, which I read not realising that it was sort of like half fantasy, half erotica. Mm-hmm. But by the time I realised that's what it was, I was halfway into it. I was like, oh, I'm not going to read this anyway. which is quite entertaining. And it's a woman who basically discovers that she is a witch, but she only discovers it once she moves and buys this house out in the middle of nowhere, in this place which turns out to be a very, very weird place that's in a hotbed for supernatural creatures.
Right.
And with the house comes an incubus. So buy house, get free incubus. But that, you know, there's something quite unhealthy about that relationship, because while she forms feelings for the creature and vice versa, he is feeding and she's actually becoming quite ill with it as well. It's a trilogy, and that's quite interesting. There's also The Witching Hour by Anne Rice, which mm-hmm. is a huge tome of a book, and the incubi-like creature in that, Lasher, is actually the ghost of a Taltus, which is one of the giant creatures.
Yeah.
Not that you find that out till the third book, so spoilers, sorry guys. But that creature has a grand plan. He was accidentally called up in a stone circle in Scotland by one of the early Mayfair witches, who didn't really know what she was doing, and then he followed that witching family up until the 21st century, line breeding them. So basically causing regular intervals of incest between brothers and sisters and uncles and nieces, etc., to increase the genetic potential of the witch line.
Right.
up until you get Rowan Mayfair, who can, once she, who's sufficiently powerful telekinetically on a biological level, that she can give birth to a body that the creature can inhabit, which is what he's after. Well, I suppose this gets a bit gross, but then there's a lot of mother and son incest once she's given birth to it.
Right. Yes, of course, naturally.
The story itself is very compelling and quite interesting, but, you know, go into it knowing that there's lots of non-approved sex in there. And the last one is by a writer who I'm a big fan of, which is Kim Wilkins. She's an Australian award-winning fantasy author, and she wrote a book called Grimoire,
mm-hmm.
which is about a group of youngish adults. I say youngish adults. About Madeline's age. Not Madeline's age, not my age, I'm past it now. I'm too old for incubi.
I'll keep that in mind.
But they find, they go away on a retreat and they discover this grimoire, and none of them can read it, but the grimoire contains the secret to life after death. They realise that the house they're living in was once owned by this alchemist, who you find lots of very seedy stuff out about this alchemist. But the alchemist had adopted a boy off the streets at one point, mm-hmm. and then the boy dies, and you don't really find out how, but one of the girls who's part of this group starts to get visited regularly at night by this ghostly figure, mm-hmm. and they're not just having tea and cookies.
Well, I see, yes.
And again, very, very compelling story, quite creepy, and like nearly all of Kim Wilkinson's stories, leaves you at the end feeling a little bit like you've been kicked in the groin. Because that's what she does. So I highly recommend anyone check out any of her books, because she's just absolutely awesome, and I don't think she's like sung about nearly enough.
Okay, I will definitely check that out.
So yeah, the idea of this incorporeal creature that you know, even if you wanted to, which in all of these cases no one really wants to, you can't fight it off because it's incorporeal. You can only drive it away with your mind if you're strong enough to resist it, and most of the time people aren't.
Yeah.
So very much part of the demon lover incubus type thing, and generally the sex is pretty wild.
Yeah, it's all about that wild sex, isn't it?
Yeah. There's not, I mean, aside from Lasher and the whole sort of I'm going to breed witches together until I get one that's strong enough to make me a body.
Mm.
It's not really about reproduction. A lot of it's just about sort of general feeding or something repeating a pattern because it needs the closeness.
Yeah. Well, it's not quite the same thing. It's the case with the Embar Regan that you find out, this is a spoiler for Blood of the Delphi. Embar Regan is the Gankener in the Hamartia cycle who feeds on love and lust. But he's the son of the queen of the Unseelie court, a Fomori goddess named Nycniven.
Who is uber creepy.
She's uber creepy. Now, Nycniven is a queen and she wants an heir. Except Nycniven will not accept anyone as the heir who isn't essentially her.
Slight problem there.
I know. She's basically just wants to give birth to someone who's stronger than her or someone who is her because she's the only one who can be it. It's a bit crazy. So what she does is the first thing she did was that she grabbed a human so that someone who didn't have any power at all so that her power wouldn't be diluted with anyone else's. And she had a son with them. She killed the human, then she raised her son, then had a child with her son, and then kill her son, raise that child, and the situation continues. So she just keeps having sons, then she has sons with her sons, and she kills the sons, and it keeps going on. So Embar Regan is the latest in that line, and the idea is that eventually she will produce a child who's only her by cutting off, by halving it every, you know.
Yeah.
But it obviously will never actually entirely work. but
you
yeah.
Think?
Yeah, I mean, but you can't reason with this woman. She's a Fomori.
Well, I can reason with her, but I think it would involve a very sharp iron blade.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's Nycniven's idea. But one of the things I enjoy writing is that Embar has run away because he knows what his destiny is. And his destiny is to have sex with his mother, produce a child with his mother, and then his mother will kill him. So that's not an entirely great, you know, future plan. That's certainly not something that, you know, you go to the careers advisor with. So, what do you want to do in the future? Well, I've taken a leaf out of Oedipus's books, and I'm thinking, no. So, obviously, that's not great. So he's sort of fled, but he is absolutely drawn to her, and he is actually incapable of love, of romantic love, as a character. He can like people very much. And he's lustful and stuff like that. And he prefers men over women. But he is incapable of love because the only thing that he can actually love is his mother because he's absolutely tied to her in every way. And he is a part of her in a very significant way. And his entire purpose is to be just a, a receptacle for her ambition to produce the perfect clone of herself because she can't produce asexually and this is the way that she's doing it. It's essentially what's happening. It's super gross.
That's like so twisted.
I know.
Don't know where to start.
But the idea is that he's an incubi who's the victim of another incubi, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess it's like having a predatory fish that's preyed on by a bigger predatory
fish. Except that he's absolutely drawn to this other predatory fish, regardless of the fact that he knows it's bad for him in every way. You know, he doesn't want to be with Nycniven. He knows he shouldn't. He's absolutely disgusted by the entire thing, and he knows that it means death. And yet, his every bit of his body says, I need to go back. And so it's again, it's a completely twisted look at that, what is right and pure mentally and what your body wants. And in this case, what his body wants is a betrayal of who he actually is, rather than the other way around.
Yeah. And that is something that's quite interesting about the whole demon lover idea, and that is that it can be a reflection of the changing morals and values of the time,
yep.
or the repression of those same morals and values. Or the fact that
yep.
the morals and values are oppressing you, obviously. Hence the, yes, I know you've been away at sea for 9 months, but I swear that this child, I haven't been seeing any of the men.
So what happened was a demon came to me.
It wasn't my fault. I couldn't turn him away. Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of bits that I would like to talk about. I'm going to mention werewolves, because we never talk about werewolves.
Let's talk about werewolves.
Obviously, the traditional werewolf, it's not a cool thing. It's completely involuntary. The beast within is let out, and it's far more like an infection than it is like this great superpower. It's not great. Once the beast is in control, that's it. The person is gone until they wake up in the bloody remains of whatever they've killed the night before. And traditionally, they were nearly always men. I wonder
yeah.
if there's a parallel there somewhere. But what I always found interesting about the werewolf legend, I saw, I think it was on Tumblr, this great cartoon that I'd reblogged before of basically the idea was that if someone truly loved the person the werewolf really was while it was in wolf form and reached mm-hmm. out a hand, the wolf would change back. Technically, that's not what happens. If you truly love a werewolf, you need to cut its head off because it'll stand still for you. And then you might get the person back, or you might not. You might just have killed them. But hey, you'll have got rid of a werewolf. But what always struck me as really poignant about that was only somebody who really loved the werewolf could ever deliver it, either through death or from the curse entirely.
Right.
And it's reflected, I don't know if you've ever seen An American Werewolf in London.
I have not seen that.
Okay, you need to see that because it's very funny. And gross, but very, very funny. It's an absolute classic, which I quote, so you won't get it if you don't watch it.
Right, got it. I will get it.
I'm doing homework this week. But, spoiler, at the end, that weirdly enough, you find in a lot of werewolf stories that the man wasn't really that fussed about settling down and having a relationship until he became infected, became the wolf. The wolf's drive to find a mate for life leads the man to fall in love with someone. So basically, the two parts of the being, the wolf and the man, aren't compatible because one's always seeking the other's destruction. Which, you know, of course that appeals to me because it's really twisted. But at the end of American Werewolf in London, the woman he's fallen in love with, who's fallen for him as well, sort of calls out his name and the wolf pauses and they manage to kill it.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have been able to because nothing has stopped it, including being hit by a double-decker London bus. Nothing has stopped the werewolf at that point. Nothing can bring it down.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's something there. That's a very dark and quite poignant, tragic side of the whole demon lover thing.
Yeah.
The other one I wanted to mention, which I've actually kind of tapped into a bit for book four, and I've got to be really careful not to give you any spoilers.
I'm very excited. Go on.
Okay. The ultimate demon lover would be Lord Death himself. So you take the myths of Persephone and Hades, for example, but there's stories that have been built on that myth. For example, I can't remember the name of the author now, but I will check. There's a book called Ketura and Lord Death, and it's a really, really good story. Basically, Ketura is this beautiful girl who's very intelligent, but not so intelligent that she doesn't get herself lost in the woods one night, and she should die.
Mm-hmm.
Set in medieval times, she should probably die because she's out in the woods at winter, at night time,
right.
and by herself, without the appropriate clothing. I mean, a coat. Obviously, she's not wandering around naked or anything. And a horseman comes along on a black horse, and he's beautiful and terrible. She says, no, I'm not going with you, even though she can't move. She's like slumped under a tree, practically dead. And he's like, okay, why are you not going with me then, Ketura? And she's like, I've got too much to do. and Lord Death, for it is he, basically says, okay, tell me what it is that you've got to do. And then he lists everybody that she cares about that she says that she needs to do things for. She needs to ensure all these things are done before she can die. He says, well, that's not going to work because I know the plague's coming. So all these people are going to die. This is the order they're going to die in, because he's a real cheerful person. He's not been properly socialised at this point. And it just goes on from there, and Ketcher is like, well, no, that's not going to happen, because I'm going to go back and I'll do this, and then the plague won't come, etc., etc. And she makes a bargain with him, because she intrigues him. And she says, I will come back here tomorrow night and I will tell you the next part of this story. And he's like, okay, I suppose an extra day won't make a difference. And of course, I don't know when she sleeps during this book, quite honestly. But she goes back and starts making the preparation. She thinks, bugger, I kind of need another day. So she meets Lord Death again and says, well, here's the next part of the story, and I'm going to end it on a cliffhanger and not tell you anything, because I need to go back for another day.
She does Scheherazade.
Basically, I mean, not for 1001 nights, but that's what she does. And by the time she gets to, I think it's the third or fourth day, she's basically on the second go-round made a bargain to say that if she can find her real, true love in the next 24 hours, then Lord Death will let her go. And she's like, sort of spins it out again, and for another day, and another day, and another day. And what she ends up doing is kind of matchmaking everybody in the village with the person they really should be with. Everyone except herself. And she gets back on, I think it's the fourth or fifth night, and she's like, there really isn't anyone in the village for me. And she said, because I've been in love with you the whole time, kind of thing. And Lord Death's like, oh, thank God you finally realised.
Can we go now?
Yeah, and it's a short book, and it's absolutely awesome. It's one of the best retellings of an old folk song I've ever read. And there are obviously darker versions that have been written adult-wise. And anyway, I obviously like to draw on folk songs and folk themes, and I have drawn on that just a little bit in book four.
I'm very excited. And also absolutely terrified of what you've done.
You should be a bit terrified.
No! I think we've actually run out of time.
We have. We're going to have to stop there.
Well then, I was going to ask, tell us, audience members, what's your favourite kink? No, don't tell us your kink. That could get awkward very, very fast. But do tell us about any books you've read recently, or films, or etc., that you've read, watched, or listened to, which have involved an incubi, a demon lover. Did it end well? Did it end badly? Do you agree with what we've said? Do you not agree? Leave us a comment, and thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.